High-speed trains will change how we live, shifting commuters away from cars and tourists away from planes. Faster, more comfortable journeys can also help to connect communities. To find out how high-speed trains could change Britain for the better, head to wired.uk/Hitachi-rail. Coming up today, lucid dreams, lonely penguins, and our predictions for 2021. Welcome to the Wired UK podcast, your essential weekly catch up on all the big stories in tech, science, business and culture. I'm your host, James Templeton, and joining me this week are Amit Kelwala.
Hello.
Matt Burgess.
Hello.
And Vicky Turk.
Hi.
This was the week when US President Donald Trump was suspended by Facebook and Twitter after posting a number of messages in support of a violent mob which stormed the US Capitol. Both platforms stopped short of a full ban, but there is growing pressure to take more definitive action.
This was also the week when the UK recorded its highest daily number of deaths from COVID-19 since the first wave of the pandemic last spring. On January 6th, more than 1,000 deaths were recorded in the preceding 24 hours, with numbers of new cases reaching more than 60,000.
It was also the week when more than 200 staff at Google's parent company, Alphabet, announced they are forming a union. The creation of the Alphabet Workers Union follows walkouts and protests by Google staff in recent years.
And finally, this was the week when Netflix raised the price of its subscriptions to reflect the increasing amount of money it is spending on content. In the UK, its standard monthly package will go up to £9.99 a month, while the premium one has risen from £11.99 to £13.99.
So Netflix always used to be a bargain, right? And arguably, it's still pretty good value. But it's been creeping up quite a bit, right? I seem to remember paying £6.99 when it first came out, or something like that. At what point does Netflix become a bit of a rip-off? Like, how high can they go?
I should say that there is still a basic package, which is $5.99, I think, and that hasn't gone up. But that's where you can only watch it in low quality on one screen, so none of this kind of rampant password sharing that we all do. Mm. I think that $13.99 is probably approaching the upper ceiling of what people will pay. But also, we're not going anywhere for the next 6 months. So it's just very much a price-wise of sort of like, what are you going to do about it? Kind of about it.
They've got a pretty captive audience, haven't they? Even with Disney Plus coming along with really, really cheap deals. Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how high they dare go. All right, what did we learn this week, the first week of 2021? Matt Burgess.
I pulled out all the stops this week, and also I've had 3 weeks over Christmas to try and come up with something. So this is my effort. It's okay, I would say. I learned that Mount Chimborazo is the piece of land which is the furthest from the Earth's center. The peak of the mountain, which is at 20,500 feet, is lower than Mount Everest and several other mountains as well. But because of the way the Earth is shaped and the thickness of the crust and all these types of things, it is actually the point which is the furthest away from the core of the planet. And if you measure it like this, Everest is only the 10th furthest high point away from the center of Earth.
Good. That's very nice. Thank you, Matt Burgess. Amit, what did you learn this week?
So we all know that Neil Armstrong was the first man to walk on the moon, but his crewmate Buzz Aldrin actually got a much higher honour. He was the first man to urinate on the moon.
Very nice. Yeah, I can... Did we really learn these this week, or was this a frantic last-minute dash to Wikipedia?
I think me and Vicky were both racing down... I certainly was racing down Today I Learned on Reddit to try and find something before anyone else got to it. But I did also remember another fact that I actually already knew, which was that in 1971, Alan Shepard played golf on the moon. So if you... there are a couple of golf balls on the moon just kind of kicking around a couple of hundred meters from where they landed Apollo, whatever Apollo mission was, landed on the moon in 1971, sorry.
All set and ready for the establishment of a moon base and golf complex within the next decade. Vicky, what did you learn this week?
I learned that if you give a sea urchin a hat, it will wear it. Apparently, Some sea urchins like to hide under shells and rocks for protection, so some aquarium owners have found that if you 3D print a tiny hat for them, they will put it on. It's not a particularly scientific fact, it's just a thing, but there are kind of photos on the internet, so I'm counting it. And this comes via one of my friends and podcast listener, Joe. Thanks, Joe, for that one.
So sorry, when you say they'll put it on and wear it, like, a sea urchin doesn't have hands, so how does it put a hat on? It just sort of squelches into it.
Well, so, you know, they have, like, spines, so it'll kind of, like, put a bunch of its spines in it, and then, you know, because it usually would hide and, like, put something over it for protection, it looks like it's wearing the hat. I'm not sure
cute.
If this is good for the sea urchins. I'm not saying you should do this. I'm just
Please
saying it is a thing that someone has done.
Well, it's good to have a hobby, 3D printing tiny hats for sea urchins. Sounds fun. I learned this week that Lenin, as in Vladimir Lenin, spoke English with an Irish accent. So apparently when he started to learn English, he hired an Irish tutor. It's a weird little factoid, but it was confirmed by none other than the author H.G. Wells, who met Lenin in Moscow in 1920 and noticed that he spoke with a distinctive Irish twang when he was conversing in English. Bit of a weird one. It's the 499th episode of the podcast. We've come a long way. We'll be doing something a little bit special for episode number 500, and we'd like you all to get involved. Email podcast@wired.co.uk. Tell us who you are and where you're listening from, and if you like, how long you've been listening to the show. We know a lot of you have been with us from the very beginning, so do get in touch, and we'll aim to give as many of you a shout out on the 500th edition of the show as possible. podcast@wired.co.uk. But we've still got one more episode to get through until we get to number 500. So the first story of episode 499, Amit, is about lucid dreams.
That's right, yeah. So you might remember that earlier this year we reported on a rise in weird dreams that had apparently been sparked by lockdown. There was something about living in these unprecedented times, in inverted commas, and being trapped in the house for 23 hours a day that meant that people were having particularly vivid dreams. Some people have also been trying to enhance their dream experiences deliberately through what's known as lucid dreaming. So lucid dreaming is a phenomenon where the dreamer becomes aware that they're dreaming while still in the dream, and they can exert some control over what happens, so they can decide to, you know, fly or to do something that they can't do in real life in their dream, whether that's, you know, going to the moon or skiing or, you know, a bunch of different things. And you can kind of steer the dream in the direction you want to go by being in this weird kind of semi-conscious but also dreaming state. It's become increasingly popular during the pandemic. There was a significant spike in online searches for lucid dreaming during the first lockdown in March. It's relatively uncommon. Around 55% of people have experienced one or more lucid dreams in their lifetime, but doing it regularly is quite rare. So about 23% of people have them once a month or more. But as seasoned lucid dreamers confirm, controlling dreams is no easy feat. It's the kind of thing that you can do, but it requires time and practice and dedication. So obviously tech companies are jumping in to try and remove all that with these kind of products and devices aimed to encourage lucid dreaming. But as we discovered this week, there are some concerns about these devices.
So what do these devices actually do? You'd imagine that some of the tech in this space is a little bit questionable, but how do they actually work?
Yeah, so the kind of origin of these devices goes back to the 1990s. So scientists back then observed that shining lights in a participant's face while they were in what's called REM sleep, which is rapid eye movement sleep, which is the kind of point at which you're most likely to dream. They found that if you shine lights on a participant's face in what was probably quite a cruel experiment, you get more lucid dreams. So these devices try and do the same thing. So they kind of they wait till you're in REM sleep, and then they try and stimulate your brain or kind of move you into this state where you're more likely to lucid dream. So there's a bunch of different devices. There's one called the Nova Dreamer, which was one of the early ones that's no longer on the market. There's a new one called Remy, which is a mask that supplies custom light patterns within, you know, it's like a sleep mask that you wear over your eyes, and it shines kind of custom light patterns. This raised almost £500,000 in a Kickstarter campaign and has attracted a bunch of attention. So the red flashing lights of the machine might be end up being incorporated into the person's dream as like the flashing lights of a fire truck, and it acts as a signal within the dream to the sleeper that they are dreaming. It's all very kind of inception-y, but that's kind of the theory behind it anyway, although the extent to which it works is questionable. And then there's other kind of less common devices that zap the brain with mild electrical currents to try and stimulate certain parts of the brain related to critical thinking. And again, the idea is to kind of try and wake the person up within the dream without actually waking them up in order to kind of induce the state of lucid dreaming.
They all sound very good in theory and everything like that, but I guess the really big question on any of this is, does it actually work and does it make you dream like this?
Yeah, and that's the problem. You know, these devices are very hyped up and they all sound very sort of, you know, compelling. You know, wear this headband and you know enhance your dreams, whatever. But sleep experts warn that those devices don't really live up to their promises, and that people actually risk doing damage to their physical and mental health by experimenting with them. So REMI has not lived up to its promise of allowing users to kind of dream better, which was the company's slogan. The device has attracted loads of negative reviews. They describe it as kind of fundamentally useless, super uncomfortable. People complain that the device just wakes them up. Some people complain about sleep paralysis, which is slightly frightening. Daniel Love, who is a leading dreaming expert, says he's tried virtually every device on the market and that the technology behind them hasn't really changed much since they first emerged in the 1990s. He says the science behind them is very, very primitive and that they kind of prey on people's ignorance. You know, the devices are expensive, but the technology in them is basically technology you might buy in a pound shop. It's flashing lights and a timer and, you know, kind of really cheap electronics. He says it's a bit like strapping an alarm clock to your forehead. He says sleep is absolutely vital to one's general health, but the producers of these devices rarely respect or acknowledge this.
So these devices might not really have a great impact on your dreams. It seems that some people are quite disappointed, but could they have a negative effect? Could they actually be dangerous?
So the simpler ones that kind of flash lights into your eyes and things like that, they might wake you up. There's no real sign that they are inherently dangerous in terms of the actual process isn't dangerous. The brain zapping ones, we've written in the past about things like transcranial direct current stimulation, which is a low voltage current that people use while awake. And so those could have a similar effect to these kind of brain zapping sleep devices, which, you know, if used incorrectly or used for too long, could actually alter your brain chemistry. So that could be dangerous. And then there's also the kind of, I guess, the physical danger of these devices. You know, wearing a battery close to your face while asleep in a warm environment, you know, it's a risk. It's a fire risk more than anything, you know, as is true of any kind of electrical device that is put in that environment. Then there's the kind of wider risk that these people who have bad experiences with these devices might be put off from the idea of lucid dreaming altogether, which would deny them some of the benefits of lucid dreaming, which could include everything from treating addiction through to treating PTSD or boosting memory.
You said that the technology hasn't changed much since the 1990s, but if we've got projects that are raising £500,000 or dollars on Kickstarter, there's obviously a lot of interest, so there must be some quote-unquote innovation in the space. So what new things are companies trying to try and crack the lucid dreaming market?
Yeah, so one of the things they're looking at is kind of trying to pinpoint exactly when REM sleep occurs, so they're not just kind of randomly shining lights on based on a timer system or whatever. So there's a product called the ZMAX headband, which combines the stimulation of the REMI headband, which I talked about, with an EEG reading of brainwaves. So, you know, this is exactly how REM sleep is measured or can be measured by these brainwaves. You show a much kind of slower pattern of brainwaves when you're in REM sleep compared to normal brain activity. So this device kind of targets that and then tries to stimulate lucid dreaming using lights and tactile stimulation. It is, according to an unpublished study from one of the researchers that we spoke to for this piece, the most successful lucid dreaming device available, with a 55% success rate in inducing lucid dreams, which, you know, doesn't sound great, but that's kind of a measure of where these devices are at more generally. It is, however, designed for kind of research, so it's really aimed at like researchers who are conducting research into dreams rather than for consumer use. And actually, when it's used by individual consumers, the success rate drops to about 15-20%. But, you know, there is, as you said, James, there's kind of constantly innovation going on, and the people we spoke to think that it won't be long until a combination of kind of brain scans and machine learning might help devices kind of pinpoint more accurately what's going on when we're dreaming, when REM sleep starts, and kind of how to influence it. One of the people we spoke to thinks that in 5 or 10 years we'll have a device with an almost 100% success rate for inducing lucid dreams. But until then, I think it's kind of a buyer beware situation where, you know, if one of these devices sounds too good to be true, it probably still is.
So why did interest in these spike so much during lockdown? Is it because we're all stuck at home for 23 hours a day and it's quite nice to fall asleep and have a dream over which you have some control? Is that what's going on here?
Yeah, I think we talked about it back then, how people were having kind of really weird dreams anyway during lockdown. I suspect you'll probably see a similar pattern for a lot of similar things to lucid dreaming, just kind of interesting kind of quirky hobbies that people maybe wouldn't have had time to explore or wouldn't have had the inclination to explore when they had, you know, things to do outside. But it's one of those things that you can try at home. You know, you don't really need any equipment or, you know, stuff for it. You can try it without any devices. You don't need to go outside to do it. It's something that kind of helps people, I guess, get a sense of being away from their current situation without actually leaving it. So maybe that's why it spiked in popularity.
I wonder if we've got any lucid dreamers out there in the podcast audience, and anyone that's tried one of these devices and either had a good or bad experience, do let us know. podcast@wired.co.uk. And there's lots more detail in the story which we published on the website, which we'll include in the show notes. Our second story this week is about very, very lonely penguins, Vicky.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. So this starts with a bit of a personal story, actually. Just over a year ago, when travel was still a thing that people did, I went on holiday to Argentina. And while I was there, I visited a place called Ushuaia, which is right at the southernmost tip of Argentina. It's known locally as the end of the world, because the next place you get to is basically Antarctica. So it's probably not really the kind of typical environment you might imagine if you think of the country of Argentina, which obviously is a huge place with quite different climates throughout the country. Anyway, one of the top tourist attractions in Ushuaia is penguins. On an island in the Beagle Channel called Martillo Island, there are colonies of Magellanic and Gentoo penguins. If you don't know your penguins, Magellanic penguins are quite weird. They're probably not what you think of when you think of penguins. They are black and white and waddle, but they're rather small and they dig burrows underground for their nests, which is quite strange penguin behaviour. Gentoo penguins are a bit larger and they collect rocks to build their nests off the ground. So they're quite different types of penguin, but they're both there on Martillo Island. But when I visited, I was surprised to see among these penguins another species. One single king penguin stood on the beach looking out to sea. He was the only one. King penguin's much bigger than those two species I mentioned, so he stood out like a sore thumb.
So as you said, you know, Ushuaia is kind of famous for penguins. So why were you so surprised to see this particular species there?
So basically, there isn't a colony of king penguins on Martillo Island. And the king penguin is a much more typically penguiny penguin. So it's the second largest type after the emperor penguin. It's got orange cheeks and yellow-orange plumage at the top of its white belly. They're not known to live on Martillo Island, so it was surprising to see one there. And afterwards, I couldn't stop thinking about this single penguin on its own. Why was it there? Where did it come from? Was it lonely? I recognise I'm probably projecting here. I don't know if penguins are even capable of feeling loneliness. I'm probably anthropomorphising quite a lot. But yeah, my thoughts were with this penguin. And so for a long time, I was trying to find anyone who knew anything about it, which was quite difficult. But eventually I tracked down some penguinologists in Ushuaia to find out more.
And they have, of course, answered all your questions, and now you know what the deal is with this penguin, right?
Well, not quite. It turns out this penguin is a bit of a mystery. First up, he or she is actually not alone, so we don't have to be too concerned about the penguin being lonely. The researchers in Ushuaia have actually been catching king penguins on their camera traps for some years now, and they reckon they've seen a maximum of about 6 at a time. It's actually really hard to know exactly how many there are because they can't distinguish between individual penguins on the cameras. So they don't know if the same ones are coming back or different ones keep visiting the island, but they can basically judge it just on how many they've seen together in one frame. So they know there's at least that many. But really, aside from that, we don't know much about them at all. Andrea Rea Ray, one of the researchers I spoke to who works at scientific organisation CADIC, says that they likely got there by accident. King penguins basically swim around looking for food. They can travel really long distances. But when it's time to molt their feathers, they head back to land. Now, usually they'd go back to the colony that they came from. But she hypothesises that maybe the penguins were nearby, in the ocean, looking for food, fishing. It was time to molt. They looked around, saw other penguins on Martijo Island. And even though they were a different species, they thought, oh, great, let's just head over there.
If you look at this place on a map, it's kind of appropriate to call it the end of the world. It is so, so far from anywhere. So even if these penguins were out on a hunt for food, it seems extraordinary that they'd end up here, because it's a really long distance from anywhere else that we know that these penguins actually live or lived previously.
Yeah, there's a few places that they could have come from. And actually, the two colonies that are on Martijo Island, so the Gentoo penguins and the Magellanic penguins, they are quite recent colonies. You know, they haven't been there for decades and decades and decades. I think the Magellanics have been there since the 70s and the Gentoos since around the 90s. So they also kind of started elsewhere, and then some penguins decided for whatever reason to start up on this island, and the colonies have grown since. So we don't know where these king penguins started from, where have they come from, but there are some ideas. So the Gentoo colony, we know from genetic testing that those penguins originally came from a colony on the Falkland Islands. Now there's also king penguins on the Falkland Islands, so they could have come from there too. We've also got king penguins across the border in Chile. There's a few places there that they could have come from. And then there's some islands sort of between Argentina and Antarctica. There's an island called Staten Island and there's one called South Georgia. And both of those have king penguin colonies. So there's multiple places they might have come from. As I say, we don't really know whether they purposefully came to Martijo Island or whether they just ended up there by accident. There are reasons that penguins might leave a colony. If a colony gets too big, so there's too much competition, if there's not enough food source, if there's too many predators, you can see kind of mass migration and new colonies form. But here it seems like there's sort of a small group that have ended up in this new place. The reason we don't really know much more about what's going on here is because the researchers haven't done much testing or really anything on the king penguins in particular. Because there are so few of them there, they don't want to disturb them. So they're kind of just leaving them be. And yeah, it means it's all a bit of a mystery.
I guess, like, you know, you kind of describe these islands and there's some of them have got penguin colonies, some of them haven't, and all these different areas with different colonies. Is this kind of how a new colony basically starts, is a penguin or a few penguins kind of randomly end up somewhere and then end up founding a new colony almost by accident?
It can be. And that's sort of what's happened with, for example, the Gentoo penguins on Martijo Island. But it may be quite difficult for these king penguins to establish a colony. The researchers think that when they first started showing up, they might have been juveniles because they didn't seem to breed. But in the past few years, they have managed to lay an egg. And last year, for the first time, they actually hatched a chick. But the chick didn't live very long. We don't know why. We don't know what killed it. It could have been that it was quite warm at the time for Ushuaia. Although also it could be very difficult for a lone king penguin chick to survive winter and the cold temperatures on the other end of the spectrum, because king penguin chicks often huddle together to stay warm. And obviously, if you've only got one, it can't really do that very effectively. And king penguins in particular take quite a while to have and raise a chick. So starting a colony from just a few individuals could be quite tricky and certainly would take a long time. Doesn't mean it's impossible.
You mentioned at really the start of the section that after you went there, you were obviously really intrigued about what this at the time you thought one king penguin was doing, and were on the hunt for the answers about it. Do you know if you're ever going to get to a stage where you'll get some proper answers about what is actually going on with these penguins there, and if the researchers are studying them any further?
So at the moment, they're not specifically studying too much about the king penguins. Their work is focused still on the Magellanic and Gentoo colonies. And for the past year, they actually unfortunately haven't been able to get out and study the penguins much anyway because of COVID-19 and restrictions preventing them from doing so. They were able to get out and change the batteries and memory cards in their camera traps, but they couldn't visit, they couldn't take their usual samples. And they say this could have a real impact on research, especially those longer term population studies and projects. Their observations of the king penguins at the moment have really come when they're doing other work, and they kind of caught them by accident. So the king penguins seem to be particularly friendly with the Gentoo penguins in particular, often hanging around their nests. And apparently one of the kind of tourist group leaders says that he thinks one of the king penguins thinks it's a Gentoo penguin because of the way it behaves around sort of their colony. But in general, the researchers say that it's really important to study penguins because they are, they say, sentinels of the marine environment. So by studying penguin behaviour, like where they go, what they eat, that kind of thing, you can get lots of information about the marine environment beyond just the immediate welfare of the penguins themselves. And this could give us insight into, for example, how the climate crisis is affecting marine environments. So I'm sure they will continue to keep a close eye on all of the penguins. And, you know, you never know, maybe in a few decades' time, we'll have a new colony to be interested in.
It's a really nice story for reminding us all that life still goes on beyond the walls of our houses and flats. Do have a read of the full story. We'll include a link in the show notes, as we do with everything that we talk about on the podcast. The third thing that we're bringing on the show this week isn't a story, but it's a challenge, if you like. Earlier this week, we set ourselves the task of coming up with optimistic and pessimistic predictions for 2021. To avoid us all talking about COVID-19, I got us to split into different categories. So Amit, let's start with you. I got you to gaze into your crystal ball and come up with some optimistic and pessimistic predictions for the year in culture.
Yeah, I would like the record to state that I wanted my pessimistic prediction to be the collapse of Western civilization, but James wouldn't let me have that as mine. If it happens, I want to say that I called it. My optimistic prediction is that I think this is the year we'll finally see platforms clamp down on hate speech. You know, we've seen Twitter and Facebook this week take the unprecedented step of banning Donald Trump. And I think that the scenes in Washington will shock people into action. So I think with Democratic control over the House and Senate following the Georgia runoff, we're likely to see a much greater push for regulation of big tech in the United States. And I think, therefore, the rest of the world too, you know, will follow. Obviously, we've seen kind of EU take leadership on this, but I think the fact that these platforms are by and large US based means that the changes they make there are the ones that will kind of become the default setting. I think we'll see Donald Trump end up getting banned from Twitter once he no longer has the office of the president to hide behind. His supporters may migrate to other platforms like Parler. They might continue to organize via Facebook groups, but I think and I hope that the damaging impact that algorithms have played in radicalizing people will be investigated, and I hope that Facebook will make sweeping changes to stop such things happening in future. So that's my optimistic prediction.
So before we go to the pessimistic prediction, so we're recording this at about 2 o'clock UK time on Thursday. So by the time people listen to this, Trump may in fact have been banned from Twitter. He's on his final strike, allegedly. Will this fix these big platforms? Is there a way of fixing these big platforms, or are they so structurally complex that it's almost window dressing, isn't it? I mean, removing Trump will make a difference, but is it going to make enough of a difference, or are we really waiting years for quite chunky legislation to be brought in to make them operate in a very different way?
I think that the challenge is not just fixing the platforms, but also like I feel like fixing the platform isn't going to fix the problems that they've caused within society, I guess. Like, you know, if you fix Twitter and ban hate speech properly, then a lot of people will just flee to other social networks. And maybe they won't have as much of a pull on the sort of public conversation if they're kind of, you know, annexed off in Parler or Telegram or wherever. But, you know, in a way, I don't know whether it's better to have people on a major platform having these discussions in kind of the plain light of day, or kind of hidden away in, you know, groups that, you know, people don't have access to, that we can't see what they're talking about. I'm not sure whether that's better or worse, because obviously on Twitter, the conversations then get amplified by mass media, but on Parler and Telegram, they don't to the same extent, but equally there's no oversight or scrutiny of what's going on, what discussions are having, what things are being planned. So it's a really tricky conundrum.
It's quite telling that your optimistic prediction is tainted with pessimism. So let's go on to full pessimism. What's your pessimistic prediction for the culture industry in 2021?
Yeah, so there were a lot of options to choose from. I've focused on the cinema industry. My pessimistic prediction is that the cinema industry is going to take years to recover from the pandemic, and that it may never fully be the same again. So this week I've spent some time looking at the film releases that have been scheduled in for 2021, and the kind of release dates. But even those release dates seem hugely optimistic in the wake of the new variant of coronavirus and the spikes that we're seeing in the UK and elsewhere. You know, last year was obviously a year of kind of cinema chaos. We saw a lot of studios delaying things, bringing their big releases straight to home streaming. My pessimistic prediction is that once people have become used to paying for a release at home on the day it hits cinemas, many of them will not go back. We've also seen an impact on the production of new films. So I think what we'll end up with is a year of big releases going straight to streaming, not making as much money as they would have, and then nothing new kind of coming to cinemas for a while. And I think it's really, really hard to see kind of local cinema chains, local multiplexes surviving that storm.
And it's either fortunate or unfortunate that all of this is taking place at a time when Netflix's old rivals, the old industry, is finally playing catch up. So we've got Disney Plus, HBO Max, Peacock, lots of new streaming services coming online and attracting loads and loads of new customers. Disney Plus particularly has exceeded all expectations, and a lot of that has been built on the release of major new films exclusively on Disney Plus. So I mean, it's a pessimistic prediction, but is it the worst thing in the world if these streaming services, which we're paying quite a bit of money for, have more of the stuff that we want to watch on them when we want to watch it?
Yeah, and it's also more accessible to people who can't make it to the cinema for whatever reason, whether it's cost or you know, disability or anything like that. Like, you know, there's definite, it's just a big seismic change, I think. And, you know, it's not necessarily a bad thing. And actually, I think the kind of saving grace, one of the saving graces of the fact that Netflix, et cetera, have got so much money to spend is that it has really kind of propped up the creative industries around the cinema industry. You know, like, people are still making high budget films and television shows. It's just, they're just not being shown in cinemas as they used to be. So, you know, a lot of the people that would have worked on a blockbuster cinema release, yeah, maybe they're working on a high budget Netflix show instead, but you know, those jobs are still hopefully going to be there. But it's just sad to kind of see that, like, a way of, you know, something that's been part of our society for a century or more kind of slowly disappearing, I think is quite sad.
It's another way of the high street being hollowed out, particularly when you're talking about local multiplexes, which aren't based on industrial estates out of town. You know, these old cinemas are based in the centres of communities, right?
Yeah, you were talking before about, like, this idea that we haven't really been able to make any kind of new exciting memories during the pandemic because we've all been locked down. And I think, like, the cinema and theatre and music festivals and you know, live music are these kind of like shared experiences, I think, are really important. And I think we're going to see a lot of those companies kind of folding. And I think, I'm sure new ones will eventually come up and take their place. But, you know, these kind of long held institutions that have been going for decades or more may not make it through the next 5 years, which I think is really sad.
And a lot of them operating on very, very fine margins. And if even a small percentage of people are persuaded to watch the latest release on Disney Plus or Netflix rather than going to the local multiplex, it remains to be seen how that ends up panning out. All right, Vicky, we asked you to focus on the environment. So what are your optimistic, let's get the optimistic prediction for the environment in 2021 first. What's going to be good?
Yeah, well, you know what? In 2021, I think we will take the next major global step towards net zero. And I'll explain why. In 2015, you probably remember, 196 parties adopted the Paris Agreement, an international legally binding treaty on climate change with the intention of limiting global heating levels. This was seen as a real kind of diplomatic breakthrough, a real sort of international effort to finally take action against climate change. And that was a climate change conference, COP21. In November this year, the UK is hosting COP26, and it's a particularly important one for several reasons. In the Paris Agreement, there's a mechanism which requires countries to report back every 5 years and submit new enhanced goals to combat the climate crisis. So sort of ramping up from their initial commitments in 2015. The conference was supposed to be in 2020, but was postponed because of COVID. So this really is the first kind of landmark conference after the Paris Agreement. Some countries have submitted their enhanced plans already, including the UK, which has a target of reducing emissions by 68% in 2030 compared to levels in 1990. Now, I'm not saying that this is going to solve everything. I'm sure there'll be a lot of criticism as well. And, you know, there's always more that countries can be doing. Some people won't be meeting their targets. Some people maybe won't have as ambitious targets as we'd hope for. But there are potentially a few other reasons to be optimistic about COP26. One of them is that the delay actually could kind of work in people's favour, because it means that it will now happen with Joe Biden in office as US president. Donald Trump, of course, pulled the US out of the Paris Agreement, but Biden has said that he will make the US rejoin. COVID has potentially also given countries something of an impetus to consider climate in their recovery plans, almost a bit of a kind of kick up the bum to kind of think, how can we build back better, as Boris has been speaking about. And the fact that it's happening specifically in the UK, it's in Glasgow, will of course put particular pressure on the UK to make meaningful progress. So I do think it's a reason for optimism. And actually, if you think back to 2015 and the feeling around climate change then and these commitments to the Paris Agreement, I feel like the conversation has moved on quite a lot. And so I do feel optimistic. I think it's easy when you're thinking about the constant spectre of climate change and the climate crisis, it feels like this impossible thing. But I feel like, you know, maybe progress has been made in those past 5 years, and perhaps this is the moment where we can make a real change to what our plans are to keep things in check. Maybe I'm being wildly idealistic.
Well, we did ask you to be optimistic, so that's fair. I mean, and there are reasons for optimism, right? The UK now goes several weeks or months at a time without using any coal to power generation. We're using more and more renewable energy, particularly wind, where the UK is a world leader, to generate that electricity. And as more and more of our infrastructure shifts to electric, more electric cars, then renewable energy will become more and more useful as it's brought on board. But maybe just to tinge your optimism with a bit of pessimism, even though the pandemic's meant that COP26 is delayed, it also means that countries have a lot less money. The cost of the pandemic has been huge, and the cost of tackling the climate crisis is economically huge, even if it's essential. So do you think there's an argument to be made that countries won't want to splash the cash on this when they have so many other things to contend with, particularly as we're imagining 2021 will still be very much about COVID-19?
That's definitely true. I mean, there's so many pressures on countries around the world right now, right? That it's sort of, you know, there's maybe competition there for where people's focus can be. But I think, you know, because COVID is requiring countries to draw up kind of new economic recovery plans, it also gives an opportunity to maybe think how, you know, what changes can be made, given that we're having to come up with new plans regardless. And, you know, some countries have put in green requirements into those. So it could be seen either way. You could see it as, you know, this is going to make it really hard to put money into green solutions, or you could see it as this is an opportunity to start with a fresh slate and think about how we would actually build things today if we were starting from scratch. So, yeah, depends how optimistic or pessimistic you're feeling on the day, I suppose.
And in terms of pessimism, what's your pessimistic prediction for the climate in 2021?
My pessimistic prediction, I'm kind of cheating because I think this is almost like 100% guaranteed to happen, unfortunately. But my pessimistic prediction is that there will be a major deadly climate event in 2021. In the past year, we've seen lots of climate disasters. We've seen wildfires ravage Australia and California, causing hundreds of deaths. There were record numbers of hurricanes and storms in the US. There were flash floods in Indonesia. a major earthquake in Turkey and Greece. There was Typhoon Vamco towards the end of the year, which caused more than 100 deaths in the Philippines, not to mention ongoing droughts and floods that often affect the poorest communities the most. We know that extreme weather events are made more likely and can be exacerbated by climate change, and it seems inevitable, therefore, that many natural disasters caused or exacerbated by climate change will occur in 2021. And I predict that at least one of these will be a major incident, unfortunately claiming many lives.
It's not cheerful, but it's highly likely. And as these events become more severe and more regular, we're also going to see, I imagine, an uptick in the number of climate refugees, which is going to become a really, really big issue, as even though the changes that we're making in the short term to tackle the climate crisis won't really have an impact for many, many years, because things are already running out of control, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's the nature of the climate crisis, right? You can see sort of immediate repercussions from big events like hurricanes or bushfires. But then there's also the constant increase of temperatures, the constant kind of effect of ongoing disasters and, you know, things happening one after the other. And that, you know, it's sort of happening all at once. And also suddenly, you know, it's impossible to kind of measure all the impacts in one go. So yeah, you're right. There'll be sort of the constant theme of, you know, crops failing, climate refugees, conflicts exacerbated by climate change, as well as the sudden effects of natural disasters.
I think one thing that's really interesting is that, like, it's almost like the impacts of climate change on the human side of thing almost make it politically harder to make the changes that we need to make to get climate change sorted, in a sense. Like, we've seen over the last 5 or 10 years how kind of nationalism and climate denialism have sort of gone hand in hand in a lot of places, and actually it's almost like a vicious cycle where the political things that are driven by climate change ultimately because of a lack of resources or land scarcity or whatever kind of then have this knock-on effect of making it harder to pass legislation that is going to bring our carbon dioxide levels down.
Yeah, and obviously because this is an international problem, that's what makes it all the more difficult. You know, even if some countries are making these commitments and putting lots of effort and lots of money into trying to reduce emissions and bring down levels of carbon, if everyone's not on the same page, then it, you know, you're reducing the impact that can have. So yeah, it's not going to be easy.
But to go back to your point of optimism, and then we'll move on, Vicky, with a Democratic president in the White House and a Democratic Congress and Senate, the US should be able to again, as has been said before, lead the world in this sort of stuff. And hopefully it won't remain an outlier for too much longer. Matt Burgess, I ask you to put on your favorite hat, your security hat, and come up with some optimistic and pessimistic predictions for the world of security in 2021. Let's start with the optimism.
Okay, and this is tinged with a little bit of pessimism, but in the respect that I don't necessarily think it will happen. It's more hopeful than anything. But it would be good to see the very first stages of setting some rules or standards around hacking by governments and nation state actors. So criminals are always going to be criminal groups are always going to be trying to profiteer from hacking with ransomware and fraud and things like that. But it would be good to see some sort of dialogue on the sort of international level hacking. So recently, just before Christmas, we saw the SolarWinds breach, which happened mostly in the US, but has affected sort of entities elsewhere as well, which saw a supply chain attack give attackers believed to be from Russia access to US government systems, and it's a bit of a wake-up call because everybody was concerned about US election interference, but at the same time this giant breach of systems was going on, and it's easy to imagine that the US will be investigating or retaliating in some sort of way at the moment, but I sort of hope and it would be good to see a bit of dialogue going on between countries about what is acceptable and what isn't acceptable, for countries to do. We've seen lots of countries over the years, particularly China, Iran, North Korea, engaging in sort of cyber espionage and stealing secrets and things like that. And there's been talk of systems such as critical infrastructure, power grids and things like that being compromised and having vulnerabilities exploited in them, and people sitting with countries sitting within other countries' networks. And we've seen ransomware attacks on hospitals and stealing of or attempted stealing of COVID-19 vaccines. And I think that it's time that sort of countries came together a little bit and said, these are at the very least some red lines about what we can't do. We can't go after medical institutions. We shouldn't look to break into somebody's power network and cause blackouts and cut off power supplies to homes. So I think it's possibly unlikely, because countries will always be acting in sort of some ways to gather intelligence on others. But I think there should be this should be the year when we start to have conversations about this. Some of this sort of stuff isn't acceptable.
And it probably helps in a strange way that the nature of these attacks is having a more tangible impact on individuals. So when we're talking about ransomware attacks against hospitals, well, that means that hospital machinery doesn't work, that patients can't have the operations that they need, which might be life-saving. And we came quite close in 2020 to having the first person die as the result of a ransomware attack, although a court case against the hackers wasn't quite successfully made. So in terms of visibility, people are a lot more aware of this sort of stuff, which might help to ramp up the pressure on rogue states that are behaving in this way, and non-rogue states for that matter.
Definitely. And I think that is a case of lots of countries will be doing something, whether it's trying to gain political intelligence about what areas of economic growth or things like that other countries are going to focus on, and like traditional sort of like spy espionage. But I think when you're coming to things that are potentially destructive and can cause danger to life and all of those types of areas, there needs to be like people need to really internationally at the highest levels sit back and say, we can't accept some of these things happening, and there should be sort of retaliation in terms of like sanctions and things like that put in place when a countries are found to have been behaving in this way. So I think it's something that's long overdue as like a big discussion and implementing some laws on this type of behavior, but something that's pretty much very much needed.
Optimism tinged with pessimism once again. Let's go for all-out pessimism. What's your pessimistic prediction for security in 2021?
So I think that there's probably quite a few areas that I could have picked in terms of like the way that technology is being used, from sort of facial recognition to predictive policing systems, to the way that algorithms are being used untransparently in sort of like the public sector and things like that. But I've decided to go for a more of a classic one, which is a new attack on end-to-end encryption. So the type of encryption that's used in messaging apps from WhatsApp to Signal to protect people's conversations and make sure that data and things sent between people can't be accessed by anybody other than the sender and the recipient. And we've already seen towards the end of last year renewed sort of attacks politically on this type of encryption. And this is as Facebook has pledged to actually make Instagram and WhatsApp and Facebook Messenger all use the same sort of encryption platform, and basically sort of as this encryption method is growing and becoming more popular, we're going to see more political conversations around breaking this or making sure that people that data can be accessed. And it's something that these types of discussions about end-to-end encryption go back sort of 20-30 years and have been sort of like a regular drumbeat in the technological sort of political sphere. But I think that this year 2021 we're going to see that come back again, and that's going to be a frequent discussion for probably this podcast and what we're reporting on and other stuff as well. So absolutely, yeah, watch this space on that one.
This is a very direct attack on the foundations of the digital era. You know, when people talk about breaking end-to-end encryption, they often use examples of what we used to do in the past, sort of steaming open envelopes. If you could do that in the 1930s and 40s, why can't you do the same to end-to-end encrypted messages in 2021? But the tension here is that that doesn't work. Once you break encryption in one instance, you break it for everyone. So there's going to be a day of reckoning for this line of argument, and which side individual nations come down on could have a really, really profound effect on how the entire internet operates.
It fundamentally could. There is a lot of the sort of conversations around not necessarily breaking end-to-end encryption, but maybe banning it or trying to introduce backdoors or methods that where data can be accessed is led by some of the Five Eyes countries, which are the big powers in terms of sort of like intelligence agencies sharing data. So that's something that is where this conversation is led. But I think the key point that you sort of flagged there, James, is that if you break this type of encryption for one person, then it can be broken for anybody. And if there is a way for an intelligence agency to have a backdoor into being able to access the data that sent and messages that sent across here, there's no reason why somebody else can't replicate that. So it's not just you're not just breaking it for one person, you're breaking it for billions.
Absolutely. So finally, I had the task of coming up with optimistic and pessimistic predictions for COVID-19 in 2021. So we sit at a time now where 1,000 people a day are dying of this disease in the UK, and we're about to go through we're in the middle of the worst wave of the virus, and there's far worse to come, it would seem. But it seems plausible and is already becoming the case that many nations will entirely eliminate COVID-19 through a mix of social distancing measures, border controls, and vaccine rollout. I mean, New Zealand has done this already without even administering a single dose of the vaccine. But other countries are getting there now as well. So it's especially true for island nations. So the Pacific island nation of Palau, for example, it has a population of 18,000 people and has already received 2,800 doses of the Moderna vaccine. And if all goes well, it should be the first country in the world to vaccinate its entire population against COVID-19. The Vatican, the world's smallest sovereign state, it's only got about 450 or so residents, is on track to vaccinate its entire population by early February. Now, of course, speedy and successful vaccine rollouts for smaller and island nations could also help to ease the economic strain that's been placed on them through the pandemic. They might not have had a lot of COVID-19 cases, let alone deaths, but the restrictions on the global economy have really hit them very hard. So once they've got vaccinated populations, some of the restrictions that have hammered the global economy could be eased, and we should start to see, even if it's inequitable, a return to normal across many nations, and it might not be the nations you expect. I don't know what people think about this idea of the pandemic ending in different parts of the world at very different times. I mean, there's cause for optimism if you happen to be lucky enough to live in those particular countries, but we are, I think, going to enter a period of quite big inequity between countries that are able to eliminate this thing and countries that still have a really, really bad problem with it for potentially years to come.
I think it's not just about countries, it's about groups of people as well. I think, you know, effectively what we're going to have is a situation where kind of people from wealthier countries that have been able to vaccinate more people are going to basically be able to travel and go pretty much wherever they want, whereas a lot of the world is going to remain closed off to a lot of people who haven't been able to get vaccinated for a long time.
Yeah, I have to admit, it was quite difficult to come up with something that was truly, truly optimistic about the pandemic. But you do feel for particularly remote island nations where the economic damage has been profound, even if the healthcare damage has been almost non-existent, that there is an opportunity there, particularly in Australasia. Australia's got the pandemic under control for the time being, New Zealand and a lot of these smaller island nations, that there could be a whole continent there that has this pandemic under control and is able to open up its borders, even if it's just within its own local geography. So pessimistically, and this kind of links to my slightly crap optimism, we're going to see a really dangerous inequity in vaccine distribution. So there's going to be this deadly divide between the richest and poorest countries, which is what you were talking about there, Amit. So much of the developed world will get access to substantial quantities of at least one COVID-19 vaccine by September 2021. but it's a really different story for poorer nations. So the entire of the African continent is unlikely to get much of any vaccine until the middle of 2022 at the earliest. The same is true for much of the Middle East, the Caribbean, Southeast Asia, and South America. So COVAX, which is the global effort to secure sufficient vaccine supply for all countries, has secured 2 billion doses of several vaccine candidates, but concerns remain about when it will deliver these vaccines and to whom. And there's also the issue of those vaccines being approved by regulators, and then it's 2 billion doses, but that's only 1 billion people. So compare that to Israel, for example, one of the richest countries in the world, which has a world-leading COVID-19 vaccine rollout plan. It's already inoculated 20% of its population against COVID-19 at a rate of 150,000 vaccinations per day. So much as it will be good news for these countries that are able to really get on top of the pandemic, we're going to see an awful lot of countries, particularly the poorest countries, that are left waiting and won't even have vaccines for more than a year. And that will mean potentially that the pandemic rages on in a really, really dangerous way in certain parts of the world for a very long time to come.
It does seem there are many sort of reasons to be optimistic about sort of maybe people's individual circumstances in countries that get it under control, or even just with taking the UK, for example, sort of potentially more freedoms being allowed to people once there are a lot of more vaccine availability and people have had it administered. But as you say, James, that it is one of the stark realities that things aren't going to go back to normal, in inverted commas, quotes, whatever, until for the whole world for a very long time. Still, there's still going to be a knock-on effect for countries around the planet and travel and the economy and everything else for quite a while. So even though there is reason to be optimistic, I think there still needs to be some realism to the overall situation.
Happy 2021. So there are predictions, but what are yours? What's giving you cause for pessimism and optimism as we start this new year? Podcast at wired.co.uk with anything that's on your mind. And a reminder that the next episode of the Wired UK podcast is our 500th episode. We've been around for an awful long time, and we hope to be around for an awful long time yet. But do get in touch. Let us know who you are, where you're listening from, and if you like, how long you've been listening to the show for. We'll hope to give as many of you as possible a shout out on the next episode of the podcast, where we'll do something a little bit special to mark our 500th anniversary. podcast@wired.co.uk. Thanks very much for listening, as always. Stay safe, and we'll see you again next week. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Goodbye.